Huth could only surmise that either the missile's full-power re-entry into the passage, or its subsequent explosion at the heart of the totality concept complex, had distorted the shape of the reality corridor, shifting its terminus at the end. Huth rose stiffly to his feet. He took stock of himself. The left sleeve of his lab coat was fire-blackened from cuff to elbow, but he wasn't bleeding anywhere, and he had no apparent broken bones. He patted his pocket and found the instruments he'd slipped into it moments before the disaster.
Thank God.
Both the microcomputer, which was the size of a playing card, and an equally small electron microscope seemed to have made the journey intact. The other scientific tool he'd brought along he carried locked away in his brain, and that was the 25 theories, which linked all human knowledge. With just these three artifacts, he was confident that he could reconstruct most of the advanced technology of his Earth. Though the timing of the crossing had been accidental, Huth had been on the verge of departing his reality, with or without Five's approval. The most recent computer projections gave 9-to-1 odds that the predicted mass die-off of humanity would occur within the next 3 months. Based on past experience with the CEOs, he couldn't be 100% certain that they would let him use his own invention to escape. That decision had been taken out of Five's hands, and now Huth was in a position to become the most powerful man in the history of either Earth, as he saw it, a combination of Leonardo da Vinci, John D. Rockefeller, and Joseph Stalin. The man stepped to the edge of the deeply rilled Red Rock Mesa. There were more mesas in the distance on the other side of a wide desert plain, and far behind those table rocks loomed a range of snow-capped mountains. Bisecting the plain were remnants of a pre-New-Cost highway, a ribbon-straight ghost of four-lane interstate. Lying across the old highway at odd intervals were great tilted slabs, the fractured remains of fallen overpasses. At the horizon line to the northwest, the sun glared off something shiny.
Water?
If the passageway's terminus hadn't shifted very far, it occurred to him that it might even be the remains of the Great Salt Lake. As he continued to scan the landscape below, Huth saw white smoke rising in a thin column in the dead still air, indicating a human presence, if not a settlement of some sort, not more than 10 miles away.
Oh, damn!
The scientist celebrated his good fortune by dancing an ungainly jig. Then he carefully boulder-hopped down a steep chute that led to the foot of the mesa, and once there, immediately headed across the plain for the ancient roadway. Up close, there wasn't much of it left. Caustic rains had reduced the asphalt to sand and had badly pocked the concrete layer beneath. Small, delicate white flowers with bright yellow centers grew here and there along the edge of the highway, sprouting from depressions where water and nutrients accumulated. Huth picked one of the little daisies and gingerly nibbled at the white petals. Their explosive bitterness was overwhelming.
Shit!
Pale and shaken, he trudged on toward the distant smoke plume. The day's building heat made sweat ooze from his forehead. In the flat, shimmering distance lay the first of the dropped overpasses. He made slow but steady progress toward the jumble of concrete slabs. When Huth first caught wind of the rank, feral odor, he didn't know what to make of it.
Damn! Is that me?
As he continued walking, the smell got worse. Much worse. Only when the pack of robbers started popping up on either side of the ruined road did he understand the meaning of the noxious stench, and by then it was too late to run.
Shit!
The dirt-caked, tangle-bearded bandits had been lying in wait in shallow hides they'd hacked into the desert hardpan. Their clothes consisted of countless layers of greasy rags. Their boots were repaired with overlapping windings of strips cut from plastic bags. They carried battered black powder shotguns and revolvers, rusting machetes, and nail-studded wooden clubs. As the robbers encircled him and closed in, the huge man who appeared to be the leader confronted him, toe to toe. He bore spiral-shaped brands on his cheeks and forehead. The angry welts of scar tissue looked like the tracks of some parasitic worm burrowing just under the skin. Below a mustache, matted with dried saliva, Huth saw the snaggle stumps of yellow-brown teeth. The tip of the man's wide nose bore a sparse tuft of black bristle, half an inch long.
Good morning to you. I just arrived.
Without warning, someone booted Huth in the buttock so hard that his feet left the ground. His legs went numb, and his knees buckled under him when he crash-landed. The bristle-nosed robber reached down and grabbed him by the collar, hauled him upright, then punched him straight in the face, breaking his nose and knocking him unconscious. Huth came to as the big man kicked him in the ribs. He held a pair of small, flat objects in front of the scientist's bloodied face.
What are these?
No. Please. Those are my scientific instruments. Give them back. You can't operate them. They're of absolutely no use to you.
He's bossing me. This dimmy bastard's bossing me.
Huth saw another short, straight punch coming at him. There was nothing he could do about it. As his head snapped back, something cracked. A lance of white-hot pain shot through his upper jaw, and his mouth was suddenly littered with sharp shards. In a gob of fresh blood, he spat out the remains of his two upper front teeth. While he thrashed and bled, the leader showed off his booty.
Looks like pretty dark here to me. Gotta be worth a spoon or two a jolt over in Byramville.
With that, the big robber turned and started off in the direction of the smoke. The other bandits quickly stripped off the unresisting scientist's shoes and pants, leaving their victim his blood-sprayed and scorched lab coat and his tattered, gray-tinged underwear and socks. Huth waited a long time before he risked uncoiling from a fetal position in the dirt, and he didn't start walking again until the sun was high overhead. Hobbling slowly toward the shade of the nearest fallen highway overpass, he looked like the survivor of a train wreck. Blood had dried purple-black all down the front of his lab coat. He couldn't breathe through his swollen nose, and every time he sucked air through his mouth, electric needles of pain stabbed into the exposed nerves of his empty tooth sockets. As he stumbled along, he wept over the loss of his irreplaceable instruments, his permanent disfigurement, and the unspeakable cruelty of fate. He was still sobbing when he reached the collapsed overpass. What he saw there put his suffering and his predicament in a new perspective. At the foot of the largest block of concrete sat a line of sun-bleached human skeletons. He counted 14 of them, all identically posed, their backs leaning against the block, elbows resting on raised kneecaps. Some were adults, some were small children, some had isolated patches of hair on their massively caved-in skulls. A couple of feet above the row of drop-jaw grins, someone had chiseled three tall, spindly, misspelled words into the eroded concrete. Welcome to Deathlands. Cutting Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Colleen Delaney, Nanette Savard, Terrence Aselford, Christopher Graybill, Kate Torrey, Thomas Penny, and Christopher Walker. Deathlands 57, Breakthrough. Fifteen days after a massive explosion destroyed the upper floors of the Totality Concept Complex, Greta Otis Trask stood naked and alone in a windowless stainless steel room. The small, unfurnished chamber had two doors, both heavily gasketed and airtight. A warm wetness trickled down the insides of her thighs. Not blood, but the remnants of a clear surgical lubricant melted by her body heat. The CEO of Omnico, one of the most powerful people on the planet, had just had her womb stripped of all its eggs. In itself, there was nothing unusual about the procedure. On her world, the in vitro fertilized eggs of the executive class were routinely carried to term by surrogate mothers conscripted from the ranks of the white collars. Above Dreda's head on a wall bracket was a vidcam, its op light glowing ruby red. A team of faceless, nameless strangers was observing her through the fisheye lens.
Please stand beneath the ceiling nozzles.
When Greta stepped over the center sloping floor single drain, the shower spray commenced.
Damn, that's hot!
The water that enveloped her was followed by foaming, pea-green jets of bactericide,